I think curiosity has led me to where I am today. So looking at the pro game, where I think any corporation, it's being self-aware. It's a mental thing in my eyes. Like, I know what I'm really good at work-wise, and I know what I'm really not good at. You have to delegate to be successful, but I think the key with delegation is...
How do championship teams and thriving startups win? Our guest today has a national championship ring, played a pivotal role at one of the most game-changing companies of our time, and is here to share how trust, camaraderie, and high-performing cultures lead to unstoppable success. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast, the show for today's leaders who want to get ahead and stay ahead, because we believe that great leaders aren't born or made, we are constantly in the making. I'm your host, Damon Lemby, two-time best-selling author and CEO of Learn It, a live learning platform that has helped upskill over 2 million people over the past 3 decades. I'll be joined in a moment by Lyle Adams, a walk-on turned national championship winning athlete, former pro soccer player, one of the first 100 employees at Uber, and founder of Spry, a super successful startup. I'm going to ask Lyle to share with us how to overcome setbacks, why leaning into your strengths are key to growth, and his secret to building high-performing teams that win on and off the field. Can you share one piece of advice that's been pivotal to your success?
I think curiosity has led me to where I am today. Whether that was as a professional athlete, how do I get better? Being curious, like, hey, how do I improve my game, right? Because like at that level, everyone's good. So like, you know, it's a game of inches and margins. So being curious, maybe it might not be the right phrase there, but it's like, how do you get better? And then from a professional standpoint, that curiosity pushed me to like explore new avenues or opportunities, or encouraged me to apply for Uber back then because I was curious. I like to tell some folks, I took my first ride and I was like, this is magic. I had an aha moment. And everyone says in the tech world, like, once you have a customer having an aha moment, you have something correctly. But it led me to be curious about how do I get to these locations differently. So my one bit of advice would be to be curious, or have a curiosity about yourself to be better in any aspects of life.
I think that is fantastic. And, you know, I talk a lot about the Learn It All leader, and one of the key traits is curiosity. I think great leaders, great athletes, they are curious and they're humble enough to know, hey, I don't have all the answers. I don't have it all figured out. So let me learn from others, ask questions, and really listen. So that's a fantastic piece of advice. Well, let's take it back. Let's talk about your career starting and walking on at Wake Forest.
Well, that's a wild story. First of all, I need to like thank my college coaches for giving me the opportunity. So my junior year of high school, my club soccer team fell apart. Culmination of 4 or 5 different events. One of my coaches was going to law school. Another coach, unfortunately, didn't have a student visa extended, so he had to go back to Scotland. Our team manager was moving on to something else. A couple of guys were moving. So our club team kind of fell apart going into my junior year, which happens to be the biggest year of recruiting for college sports. So I somewhat fell through the cracks. Many schools in Florida were recruiting me, but I had aspirations of playing ACC soccer because I felt like I had the ability to do so. So upon senior year comes around, I talk to my parents and they go, hey, these are the schools that are looking at you, giving you potential scholarships. What do you want to do? I said, hey, I want to try my luck at some of these ACC schools. My parents said, sure. So I applied. I got into some of them. Wake Forest was one of the schools I got into. And I said, hey, I want to try to play soccer there. But obviously Wake is a top 15 program in the country. So I actually emailed the coach Raw and said, hey, I would love an opportunity to walk on. No response. On new student orientation day, I swing by the coach's office to have a conversation, right? So the day that all prospective students are on campus walking around, I decided to swing by the soccer coach and I made a pitch to him. Coach Jay would love the opportunity to walk on. As you can imagine, he was somewhat flabbergasted by this. Didn't really happen at that time, but he was respectful. He was gracious. Like the current coach, Bobby Muse now, and Coach Jay and Carson Porter said, hey, thank you so much for your interest. Obviously, like we have a good roster for next year, but we'll make some calls. If you're willing to now put in the work and just be part of the team, we would love to have you if you pass the reference checks. Fortunately enough for me, one of Coach Bobby's good friends was the coach at South Florida, and I grew up in Orlando. So he basically said, hey, the kid's a good player. We were looking at him to come here, but he wants to play ACC soccer or go to an academic school. So we kind of put her head out of the race. So that basically warm referral gave me a chance to walk on at Wake. And I'm in true walk-on, wasn't part of the plan, wasn't part of this. I wore number 30 because I was the 30th person on the roster, and that was kind of the omen. But showed up at preseason, had a good preseason, worked hard, and was fortunate enough to, you know, be named a starter for our first game as a freshman.
Really?
So, yeah, I played 4 years. I think that's one of the most, I'm a typically modest guy. One of the things I'm most proud of in my life, I'm in top five of games started and games played at Wake Forest in school history. And there's been some really great players that have played.
Wow, that's a big accomplishment, man.
So
that's great.
That's one of my things I'm actually secretly quite proud of. Like I said, it comes down to my teammates. I still give a lot of credit to my coaches because, like, soccer doesn't have a lot of scholarships, right? So having a walk-on come in and really giving them a chance to play and honestly earn their spot on the team takes a lot of, like, leadership and strength. And, like, he gave me a fair chance. He didn't have to. And I'm forever grateful for that opportunity because that's what I would say one of the change moments in my life that had really altered my trajectory. So, like, that was the story. So the walk-on just played a lot. So I have a really good relationship with all my college teammates and college coaches because we all have a lot of jokes about my experience.
That's awesome. And, you know, it's almost in reverse of mine. I went as a preseason All-American full scholarship to Pepperdine. But unfortunately, I kind of came in for whatever reason with imposter syndrome, you know, doubting myself. How did you, as a walk-on, come in with the self-confidence to just be able to do it? I think that that's something that's awesome. And I think people at any level in their career, let's say we have a listener who just got promoted as a manager, and maybe they're unsure if they can do it because they've never done it before in a room with all these senior people. How did you do that?
I don't know if there's specific steps. Like, obviously you have to have an underlying belief of, like, self-confidence, but not arrogance, right? I think there was times in my freshman year, like, I probably bordered too much on one side of that, the arrogance side, and it kind of, like, led me to, like, get
maybe
in trouble
helped.
Or not. Maybe it helped. But at the same time, like, I think I realized in some of the summer practices, like, hey, I can kind of hold my own here. Like, yes, there are things that other players are better at than I am, but there's things that I'm also really, really good at. So if I can kind of lean into my strengths, right, maybe this now works out. But I just really wanted a chance, right? You know, if I didn't play, I don't think I would have been upset, right? I just wanted a fair shot because that's what was kind of upsetting about my club team falling apart because I felt like I was not given, I didn't have the same access as some of my peers who went to better tournaments. I just didn't have a good club team. So for me going in there, I was like, hey, if I try my best and I fail, I'm good enough with that, right? I just wanted to have my best foot forward. And that ended up being good enough to impress the coaches and for them to, like, have faith in me to become and to play. So it was a really humbling experience. I mean, as a team, we made 3 consecutive Final Fours. We won a national championship. Like, so I'm forever grateful that right place, right time, if that makes sense. I don't know if it works a year later. I don't know if it works a year before. It was just like the stars had aligned and obviously you had to put the work in to get there. But with all those things, it happened to really work out positively for me.
Yeah, I understand the right place, right time and all that. But I'm also a big believer that you create your own luck, right? You know, if you didn't put yourself out there in that position, it wouldn't matter what time it was. So sure, maybe there's a little bit of luck in there, but I think you created your own luck. I don't want to just pass over this. You won the national championship. I mean, that is incredible, right? So what was it about that team? Because again, I mean, there are great teams, you know, there are people with great talent and you went, but what was it about that team that was able to win the championship?
I would say, ironically, this is going to sound odd. My college teammates might get mad at me. I thought of that was probably a second best team, no team that won. I thought my senior year team was the better team, like player wise, right? And like talent wise, I thought we were better senior than junior. But junior year, I would say the last three years at Wake, we were just close. We got along. Like the locker room was a happy place, right? There was no animosity. There was no jealousy. Like you were happy for your teammates to be successful. And that was ultimately the team success. So if someone now scored a goal, right? Most people were genuinely excited. You celebrated, you were happy. So I think we were close off the field, which I think led to us being close on the field. But we also then made a kind of a pact amongst us. We didn't really want to go through freshman year again or for first year again. I think we lost 8 games that year. We lost 7 of those games by 1 goal. The other one we lost by 2 goals. But all of us were very successful or competitive in high school, so we all hated losing. So I think that was part of the motivation of saying, hey, let's just be better. But then at the same time, you also, I think we realized we were close freshman year, right? It wasn't like we were getting blown out of the water or basically like, you know, we're getting smashed every game. 1 goal here, 1 goal there, making mistakes, things that can be corrected with hard work, effort, and, you know, commitment, right? I think that was kind of what drove us to be successful. But we also, as I said, got along. Like looking at, you know, hearing some friends who played college soccer or college sports at other places, my college teammates are wonderful. I'm probably texting one of 15 guys every day.
We're
still very, very close. We might not see each other every single day anymore. We have guys with multiple kids, jobs all around the world. But like, if someone comes to New York, there's a 95% chance I will now see them if schedules align. Or if I now go to a city with one of my college teammates now living, there's a 95% chance we're going to connect if schedules align, unless there's some kind of convenience. So I think that's what led to our successes. We got along. Like, as you know, like at that level, it's a game of margins. It's inches, right? Like for success and non-success, but you kind of have to get along to a certain extent. I think our teams at Wake had that kind of culture the last 3 years that we were just like, we were close. We partied together. We lived together. We would hang out together. We'd make fun of each other. Like we were a close group. And I think that really allowed us to really push ourselves to get to that level necessary to be successful on a championship level.
Yeah, I'm sure this is something that stuck with you in your professional career too, and we'll get to all that. I have one more question, because I think you said that maybe your senior team was even more talented. Do you felt like after you won it your junior year that maybe you didn't have the eye of the tiger or the edge anymore because you've already done it? Did that play a role in it, or?
No, our college coach ran that out of us the spring after we won. So I don't think we had it, but I think we wanted something a bit more. Like, I think if looking at junior year, we kind of said, hey, we won it, but we can be better. I think no one was satisfied with just having one, right? Because looking at it, the one that we lost my sophomore year stung. It stung. I mean, it still hurts. And I think senior year still hurts, right? Sophomore year, we lost in penalties, but we were the better team. But soccer is one of those games that if you don't put away your chances, anything can happen. And that kind of motivated us to get there. But once you now won, I think once we won, like what I think, you know, Marcus Tracy, who won the Herman our senior year, said at best, he's like, we won a national championship. We have a bullseye on our back right now. And since we didn't like losing, I think that's what motivated us to be better in my eyes. But unfortunately, we fell up short. I think we hit the post a few times at game my senior year. I think it was 3 or 4 times. Unfortunately, in soccer, if you hit the post 3 or 4 times, the likelihood of you winning a soccer game is not high. But like, I thought we were talented because at that point we knew each other. We knew each other's strengths. We knew each other's like weaknesses, right? We knew how to play with each other, but more importantly, like situationally, we could adapt to everything because we had seen it now 3 years before. So no scenario I thought was like uncomfortable, whereas some things you kind of have to like learn by experiencing it, where we'd experience everything senior year. So now it's like, oh, I know how he's thinking. We're just going to do this and this. And it was kind of like second nature. That's why I thought we were fundamentally better at that point. But unfortunately, like I said, we didn't get, the ball didn't bounce our way. And like, obviously it disappointing, but I'm still grateful that we have a national championship because like I said, those are really, really hard to have.
That's an understatement, right? And that's an amazing accomplishment that you and your buddies get to live with and, you know, glory days over the years. I think it's awesome. So from there, you were a second round pick, right? And you went into played MLS and played professionally first overseas, and then So what was that like?
I mean, it's humbling to say the least. The jump from high school to college is a lot smaller than the jump from college to pros. And I think the jump from college to professional is just the intensity. Like, we practice hard at Wake, but it wasn't the intensity. You didn't have the physicality that you saw in the pro game. Like, for context, I'm 6'2". Right. I could do most things I wanted in college from my frame at that height. I was probably like, you know, maybe a 190 dripping wet. I wasn't a lot of like thick, but I was big. In the professional ranks, like, everyone was my size. Everyone was strong. Everyone was fast, right? So like, that jump took a while to get used to. And then just the sheer length of the season. College sports in America, you play college soccer is 3 months. Maybe 4 months if you're really, really good and you get all the way to the championship game from when you start in August, right? Early August with preseason until mid-December when the college cup is. 4 months, tops. The professional leagues are 10, 11 months, right? So yeah. I think that
physically
is...
Physically
and mentally, being able now to, one, focus and get through that, but persevere when you're having these lulls is kind of the challenge. But also at the same time, like, taking care of your body, being disciplined. Like, you have a lot more free time. College is great because college is structured. You got class, you got practice, and you got homework. And you got meals in between. As a professional, you just got practice. But now the whole day is now yours. So being able to structure that. But for me, it was just the physicality of the game, right? Like, I looking back at my career now, obviously I wish I could do some things differently, but I have no regrets. I would say the biggest thing that I wish I did my first year as a professional was to really invest in my body, get stronger, right? Really get stronger to handle that just physicality of the game, but also now the 10-month season. Right? Because like, it's just going to wear on the body. And if you look at some of the successful NBA players, they kind of talk about their first pro season. They go, hey, I realized I'm not strong enough to now play 2 extra months on the top of an 82-game season because the physicality and the intensity now is at a different level. And unfortunately, you kind of have to just experience that before it makes sense so you know what you now need to achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one question that I was kind of thinking about right here you're talking is, when you get into professional soccer, right? I mean, you have college and you're in professional soccer. There are so many players who have the physical talent. So to be successful in the pros, how does it break down between the importance of your physical ability versus, you know, your mental approach to the game?
I think it's all mental at that level. I think it's 90-95% mental. Of the mental capacity, though, it's more like understanding where you are and who you are as a player. Because like in any sport, certain players work in certain systems a lot better than other systems, whether it's baseball or basketball or soccer. Some player can be a role player in one team, and they put them in a different position. Now they're now a lead contributor in some capacity. So based on that, that's why I would say it's mental for me. You kind of have to know your role. I think one of my college teammates was really good about that. Going into my sophomore year, which kind of things started clicking for me. Like freshman year, I was kind of up and down. It was rough. Like I had good games, I had bad games. I wasn't consistent. I would say like my consistency varied. Whereas going into that offseason, a couple of my teammates sat me down and says, hey man, these are the things that you're really good at. Lean into your strengths and now surround yourself or play in a situation that somewhat doesn't really expose your areas for opportunity. Yes, you can work on those in the off season, right? But like, there are certain things that you do well that your teammates can't do and vice versa. So play to your strengths, and that's the mental aspect. So looking at the pro game, where I think any corporation, it's being self-aware. It's a mental thing in my eyes. Like, I know what I'm really good at work-wise, and I know what I'm really not good at. Like, or I need areas of help on. So either seeking out that help or openly delegating or having that conversation, I think is really, really important to say, hey, it's okay to delegate or show vulnerability, but at the same time, you can't be good at everything. Like, no one can be good at everything, whereas everyone has their strengths and areas for opportunity. So I think that ties into the mental aspect of saying, hey, are you aware of that? And if you are, and you're willing now to be courageous or vulnerable to say, hey, I need help here, or this is what I'm good at, I think you can get to that success. And I guess the final piece around professional sports is looking at the NBA or even MLB, right? If you're a starting position player in the Major League Baseball, you're a very good baseball player. Like, you're a very good baseball player normally, right? We're looking at the NBA.
Even if you're a bench warmer, you're a phenomenal baseball player.
So I'm saying, like, I tell people all the time, like, if you take anybody in the NBA and you put them in a YMCA or like their pickup game or their
most competitive game, they're going
to score 100 points.
Yeah.
They might not see the court on an NBA team, but like you put them with normal people, they're going to score 100 points and make it look easy.
That's like a pet peeve of mine when I go to a baseball game or I go to a basketball game and there's somebody in the crowd, you know, talking shit, right? You know, because it's like, do you know what the level of talent it takes mentally and physically to be able to get to this level? I mean, I just have the most utmost respect, you know, for professional athletes and all of that, right? Because like you said, you can go play on the men's league afterwards and score 100 points in a game.
Oh, yeah. It's. I agree with you. I think for those, that's one thing I always respect about athletes. I think as an athlete, you have a lot of like innate qualities that will transfer really well to business. But whether they are now being disciplined and being on time, trying to be reliable and consistent, you show up every day with a positive attitude, you're trying to work, right? Because if you're getting to that level, you got to come in with that attitude at every single day to work and get better. And I think many of those traits transfer to business. I mean, being an entrepreneur, like I said, is being a lot like an athlete, right? Like a lot of the work that you're doing behind the scenes, many people really won't see, right? And they just won't see them. But if you want to be successful, you kind of have to do those steps in that process to get to where you now want to go. Because without that, that's the foundation for your success. So like whether that's 7 a.m. runs or doing tons of market research and doing the calls and the homework and the product testing, but you have to put in the work to be successful, whether it's on the playing field, court or surface or in the boardroom, you could say.
Yeah, I want to say, you know, you and I were connected, mutual friend, Jay Dixon. And what he says it best. He calls it athletic education, you know, and I love my conversation with him on an earlier episode. And it's all about how these skills are transferable. So your soccer career comes to an end, and that must have been tough, right? So what was that shift like going from being a professional soccer player into the corporate world?
I knew my soccer career was always going to end. But what made it tough was I didn't end it on my terms. Someone told me this was now over, or I didn't really have a chance to basically write my last wish. But that's 95% of most athletes, if you want to be honest.
There's only a
few special ones who get to say, hey, I'm done when I'm done, right? Whether it's now financial or I just don't want to play anymore. Most, unfortunately, are told, hey, your career now is over, right? So I think that was the hard part for me. And I really hadn't thought about what was next. I was comfortable in my own skin, but I wasn't really comfortable with who I was at that point in my career. I was still kind of young, in my early 20s. I was still trying to figure out like who I was as a person, like who Lyle Adams was, what made Lyle Adams tick. So I think that point of self-discovery on top of now not having soccer, since soccer was my identity, kind of made it really, really challenging, right? From that point of view. Then to make matters worse, my career ended kind of during the last banking crisis. So there were really no jobs, right? So you can have a lot of confidence in your abilities, but like if no one's hiring, I think I spent 8 months applying for jobs, which also now...
Was that 2008, 2009?
2000, like early 2010. Okay. Right, mid-2010 was my career ended.
Right in the worst part.
It was not a great time to be looking for a job when you had no experience. Like many of my classmates had internships in the summer where they had entry-level jobs, didn't have much because I was spending the summer working on my craft, getting better for the upcoming soccer season. So like I said, no regrets about any of those decisions, but I kind of came into that hiring arena, not really with the class of 2009, my graduating class. It was more in my eyes the class of 2012 or 2011, because I had no work experience, right? So I think that's what made the transition somewhat hard was, one, I was trying to find who I truly was as a person, right? And then not being able to secure a job, you know, as quickly as I thought I could have hurt, right? Obviously, now I'm well aware of what was going on from an economic standpoint, why it took so long. But like at the time, I was young and naive. So, well, I got good grades in school. I did these tests well. I was someone, like I said, immune to the macroeconomic environment to say, hey, no one's hiring Lyle. So you're applying for a job with someone who has an MBA or someone who has 5 years of experience, and you have a summer internship. Obviously, they would now go with the more experienced candidates, but it just took me a while to come to terms with that. I wouldn't say get over it, come to terms with the realization of it. And once I found peace in all these decisions, I think it kind of made my professional career transition a lot easier.
Question for you. So let's say we have a listener out there who's feeling like, let's say maybe they're an accountant or something and they just lost their job, or maybe they're an athlete like you and I were, and we haven't really found ourselves. What is one piece of advice that you can give them for them to help make that first step to really find themselves?
Yeah, everyone is unique and different. So I would say find the place that you're most comfortable in and just go there and think. And think about, hey, what do you want to do? Or also, what don't you like doing? Because I think the latter question for me was actually really, really helpful as I started to get better with my job search. My aunt asked it to me. She's like, hey, you keep telling me what you want to do, but what don't you want to do? And once I then realized what I was not appealed to, it kind of helped. But then she made a really, like, it still stands with me today. She's like, hey, you're somewhat new in the workplace. Your job is to get experience and to grow, right? So like where you want to go, you can get there. But looking at now doctors, you don't become a doctor your first day in medical school. You become a doctor after 4 years of training and work, or 6 years or 8 years, depending on your discipline. But the point my aunt was trying to make was, hey, as you're approaching this wrong, approach this in the steps. Know where you want to get there, or know where you want to go, and work towards that every day or every job. Because as long as you're learning and you're growing, your milestones and your goals are achievable. But if you think you're going to now jump in to go be this person right now and you got no work experience, you're set up for failure, right? So obviously it was a tough pill to swallow, but I thought, looking back at it, she was spot on. She's saying, hey, you will discover who you are as a person, an individual, what motivates you when you start doing something. Because you'll look at this, the positives, you'll look at the negatives, but through those experiences, you'll have a better sense of what motivates you, what drives you, what angers you. And as you build upon and have more of those lessons, I think you'll be easier to get to that sense of identity or who your true self is.
That's a great answer. And that was your aunt who helped you with that?
Yeah, my aunt's awesome. My dad's
Hey, I mean, she's awesome. And so let's... And so I know you got into tech and you worked at Living Social, but then you ended up at Uber and one of the first 100 employees at Uber. And as I mentioned at the beginning, it's like, I think Uber is an absolute game changer. So what was your experience like when you got to Uber? And really, did you realize it was going to have such an impact on the world?
After my first week, I knew something was special. Right. But I think it really solidified 3 weeks into the job. Like, I'm a numbers guy. I was an econ major in college and I love statistics. The law of large numbers says at a certain point, numbers start to normalize. Right. But when I kind of got settled, I was like, Uber was doubling every X number of days when I started. Like clockwork. It wasn't like, oh, we had a bad week. It was like, nope, they doubled again. Then like if you put in the days, they were doubling again. I was like, this is...
People are like, what the heck's going on?
At the time, I had this conversation yesterday with someone. I was like, this is 2012. You had really... Social media was in its infancy. All you really had was desktop, Facebook, and Twitter at the time. There was really no Instagram, right? The mobile app game was kind of developing at the time, but it wasn't as popular, as predominant as it was now, because most of web traffic was done on your desktop. So for me, seeing Uber now grow so quickly without the current mediums and channels that we now look at viral growth or all these things back then, I was like, this is wild. This is something really, really awesome, right from the back end, right? And then like you could kind of see it in vernacular. We were kind of mentioned in TV shows and like, you know, I told a story about one of my good college friends, right? Like I told him I was leaving Living Social. It's like, dude, Lyle, I need to talk to you. I think it's a mistake for your career. I don't know what you're doing right now. But if you think it's smart, it's smart. 6 months later, hey, man, like, I don't know if you heard of this company called Uber. You can request rides and like a black car. It's super cool. Here's my promo code. Can you sign up so I can get $50 of credit? Like 6 months later, he forgot I had worked there.
That's awesome.
That basically was like a full circle moment for me to say, wow, what we're kind of doing is changing. But what really was special for my Uber time was obviously the people that I worked with. I think that was what I missed most, or what I was most hesitant about leaving the place, was you worked with a ton of great, smart people, right? Like a lot of meetings I would come out feeling inspired or saying, wow, I have an intellectual crush on that person. That person is really smart. I like to think about, we didn't really go into meetings having to explain the problem. We would go into meetings and now work on solutions or ideas because everyone conceptually got the problem. So you would have a lot more productive conversations and stuff. So like, it was wonderful. Like, it's like, I look back at that period. It was like the second most transformative period of my life, right? On that side. And the other aspect that I really like, didn't realize how powerful was when you started hearing all the customer stories, the partner stories with Uber, right? Of how people somewhat struggled to get around before Uber in DC or in like different parts, cabs wouldn't go, or it was just a nightmare to communicate. Over the course of time, you press the button now and a car would show up and take you wherever you would go and not have to worry about safety or paying the driver or getting robbed. So once these things really started spreading, that was what was most rewarding because you basically, to your point, movement became ubiquitous. It was no more longer siloed or like contained to a certain people or certain locations. It was easy to get anywhere. Where I live in New York now, there's obviously a benefit of being near the subway. When I lived in DC, I used to have to walk half a mile. But Uber could take and pick you up and go anywhere you want. And I think that was the true power. And then seeing how that industry took off when I was there, like going from the concept of like, you know, a contractor employer relationship or like the gig economy in general, it opened up a lot of doors. Like seeing how some drivers were saying, hey, man, I'm retired. This is great because like, I can still now meet people and keep my mind sharp. And at the same time, I can turn off and go pick up my grandkids from elementary school and spend the afternoon with them, right? So it's like, I couldn't find a normal job that gave me that flexibility. Uber can do that. Or seeing a lot of single moms who are saying, hey, this gives me a way to make some additional income and also spend time with my kids. So like, there were so many positive stories that you saw and felt, and it was really nice to be part of the back operation staff that made these stories possible.
Yeah. I mean, Uber is basically a word now, right? Just like Xerox is for copy paper. You know, nobody says, you know, I'm going to get a Lyft. That even if you order a Lyft, you're going to call it an Uber. Did you get an Uber? You know, it's an incredible, but you were there for 6 years and there's a lot of positives, but were there any really tough times or any challenges that you could share with us?
I would say, you know, in early 2017, like, you know, the world was doing a lot of like self-reflection on what was right and wrong from a humanity standpoint, right? The Me Too movement, some of the things. And Uber had a very negative story that basically came out about one of our engineers. And it was upsetting to hear. Like, I felt for that individual wholeheartedly. The whole company basically was now put through this, you know, this tough time from a PR perspective. It was challenging because not everyone was a bad seed. Not everyone was a bad apple. There were some really good people who worked there. And I think it was now challenging as a people manager at time, hearing what now was being said about you as a company or everyone who now worked there, when in reality, you know, deep down inside, not everyone was like that. There were some good people, right? There were some, and I think that was one of the more challenging times as a organization, because many people poured their heart and soul into Uber to get to where the company was at that time. Yet, unfortunately, a few bad apples had soured the bunch. And then hearing these stories and negativity and trying to now be respectful and say, hey, everyone is not that, right? I think that was kind of one of the tougher times, if I'm being honest. Like, as a minority, I know when places aren't friendly to minorities or women. I never once got the sense of that when I was there,
Right. I love that.
I thoroughly enjoyed my time. I learned, like, if I made a mistake, I made a mistake, and I was told not to make a mistake again, but it wasn't a reflection of who I looked like or what I did or any of my other things. It was just like, I made a mistake, and there was a standard that you had to now maintain, which I truly respected. But now hearing, like I said, or seeing the news cycle drag everyone through the mud was somewhat painful, because I knew deep down inside everyone wasn't like that. Like, I'm not a negative person yet. Oh, everyone who works there is evil. Everyone's a terrible person. Like, no, like, not everyone. But then that at the time was challenging, especially being the microcosm of San Francisco, which is a more insulated place, and tech kind of dominates the culture where it did back then. It was challenging. I would say that was probably the hardest time, or being able to like talk with some of my, you know, female reports about what they were feeling, because they were also upset by it, and I fully understand why. But I would say of my tenure there, that was probably the toughest time in general.
Oh, absolutely. And you were a people manager at the time. So I'm sure there had to be some tough periods of keeping people motivated and wondering if they should even be coming, you know, sticking with Uber. What advice would you give to other people leaders out there who are listening to your story now, where they work in an organization, and let's say that they just went through layoffs or something tough, and so the team that they have has lost some of the motivation. How do you help reverse that trend for them as their leader?
Well, you have to be positive. I think as a leader, that's a pro and a con. Like, you got to have a smile on your face, right? I think obviously, like, no one wants to have workforce reductions or any of these difficult things, but they happen. Like, you can't script everything. Everything is not always two steps forward. Sometimes you take a step or step and a half backwards, but you have to kind of keep trudging forward. So I would say to the people managers, like, be honest. You don't have to like what's going on, but you kind of have to be empathetic. But I think that's the key for me, is like being authentic and being empathetic, the kind of understanding where the person's at. Pretending that nothing is wrong, I think, is going to be viewed wrongly. If unfortunately you reduce the company by 30%, you know what's happened. Right, you can be upset and be empathetic, but you kind of, like I said, if you're authentic and explain what happened or how you're feeling and how they can now cope, I think eventually your team will come around. Hopefully they come around, but there's no guarantee they will. But in my experience, I gravitate to people who are authentic, who tell you the truth, who are kind of straight shooters at the end of the day. Whether or not you might not want to hear it in the moment, when you had time to digest and calm down, or, like, you know, really like settle, you'll appreciate their perspective, because it takes a lot of courage to share that with individuals, and just being honest about your feelings and emotions.
I think that that's gold right there, by the way. And what I hear you saying is be authentic, genuine, and be transparent. Right. And you can't fix everything, but people know if you're hiding something, and they know things aren't going well. And if you don't do all of those things, Lyle, people lose trust in you. And if they lose trust in you, you have a much bigger challenge. So I think that advice right there is awesome. Let's jump forward to you leave Uber and you start Spry. So tell us a little bit about what NIL is, because some of our listeners don't know what it is. And let's get into what Spry does and how it helps its customers.
So Spry is an athletics management platform. So to answer your first question, NIL. So NIL is name, image, and likeness. So until 2021, college athletes were not permitted to make money from their name, image, and likeness. So their name, obviously Lyle Adams, their image, a picture of me, i.e. Lyle Adams, or their likeness, maybe a caricature of Lyle Adams. So until 2021, that wasn't now permitted under the existing NCAA guidelines. So if a student athlete were to pursue any opportunity there, unfortunately, it would have jeopardized their eligibility. So many didn't really do that. However, though, that law was changed. And so starting in the summer of 2021, student athletes could now make money. Spry was founded under the tenet of helping student athletes at scale navigate this new world. And the macro thesis was, not every student athlete would have an agent or a business manager. Looking at myself, I played soccer. And despite how, you know, self-confident I am, I don't think anyone was going to pay me $100,000 to do an NIL deal, especially in college, right? So I wouldn't have had a team, a group around me to surround me and put me in a position to be successful. I kind of have to do everything on my own. And that's what Spry was basically founded to be now. Hey, let's now build educational resources. Let's put everything together now across the board. So a school can not only stay on top of what their student athletes are doing, but also empower them with the resources and tools to be successful. Because most student athletes wouldn't be like a Paige Buchers or a Caitlin Clark or a Kayla Williams would have big teams to help manage their affairs. Most student athletes will be doing it on their own. And if now your deals are hundreds of dollars and tens of dollars instead of tens of thousands of dollars, you couldn't afford to pay help. So that was Spry's mandate thesis. So that's where we got our start. And it was wonderful to see how we were helping student athletes. You know, a few early success stories were, I believe in the fall of 2021, shortly after NIL went live, we ran a promotion to basically help a ton of student athletes now learn more about NIL through a series of educational videos in the app. Those who saw the video saw an 80% increase in earnings over the next 6 months. So it just showed that NIL was for everyone, conceptually. And that's what I loved about it. It's like, not everyone would make life-changing money, but everyone would have the opportunity to make money. And looking at myself as a former athlete, if I made an extra $200 a month in college, that's a big deal for me, right? In college, right? Like, obviously, as an adult, that's a totally separate thing, but in college now, that's extra food money. Maybe I can go out to dinner. Maybe I can have a couple of libations on the weekend, right? Like, that's pretty good walkabout money in college for you, right? That's the thing, that's the beauty of NIL. And from a business perspective, NIL was entrepreneurship in my eyes, right? NIL was going to teach a lot of young men and young women early on how to be business owners, how to think about your brand, how to have some of these soft business skills that unfortunately I didn't really learn until I graduated or had to now interview or do certain things. But if you're now working with a restaurant and doing a speaking engagement, you have to engage and do public speaking. These things, I think NIL will allow athletes to do a lot earlier, I think is the biggest benefit. So now you have tangible experience coming out upon your graduation day, right? So you can now hit the corporate world running.
I personally think NIL is like Uber to the taxi business, you know? As an ex-athlete myself, you know, I saw a lot of friends who didn't have any money. They couldn't work. They couldn't get paid for what they're doing. And I think it's fantastic. And the NCAA should have jumped on that a long time ago. I mean, they really should have. And but I love that we're here now. And I love what you're doing to support it. And so let's talk a little bit about Spry's growth, because I believe you're up to about 200 customers.
Yeah, we've had an amazing run recently. Like, I would say since last year we expanded the feature set. The reason for is our customers were asking for more. Coming out of COVID reset the sports industry on a macro level. Many activities within sports organizations were always in person. Come to my office, come to this auditorium, we'll have a team meeting. Many things were always in person. When COVID happened, everything became virtual. And now many of these organizations or athletic departments were buying a series of horizontal solutions across the board to get their operations or tasks done. While this led to short-term efficiency, it led to long-term inefficiency because now I had 8 or 9 different platforms I was using. I had 9 different logins. I had tons of spreadsheets with scattered data. So hearing all this customer feedback, we decided to verticalize. Hey, let's put all these core functions into one platform. Let's do paperwork. Let's do scheduling. Let's still provide practical education for NIL. Let's do NIL management. But let's add roster management, competition. Let's put everything into one app. If everything's now in one platform, this now can allow us to be successful at scale because we can sell into all types of schools, not just those heavily focused on NIL. So since we expanded the feature set last summer, we've probably grown 5x, right? Like, it's been really humbling and rewarding to see that, you know, the vision that we've laid out as a company has now become a reality. So it's great there, but like anything good, it comes with a lot of sacrifice. Being a startup is hard. I tell people all the time, you hear a no way more than you hear yes. And I think as the great Ted Lasso says, you got to have the memory of a goldfish.
Absolutely. And that's one question I have for you right there. You know, for our listeners who maybe want to be a founder, what advice do you have for the founder, especially where should they be spending their time?
As a founder, you have to have a real good sense of what's important for that given period in the company. Like right now, my business has seasonality to it in that there's a clear buying season when most of our contracts are signed. There's a clear time to train and implement, and there's a clear time to refine and improve, right? So I would say to any business owner, like, you have to really know your space. I think that's the bigger North Star for me instead of like where you spend your time. So you really have to know your space and know your team, right? When to lean in, when not to lean in. Like in the middle of or peak season, I spend a lot of time helping business development, right? Whereas that now priority might shift and focus more on product development now during our improvement cycles, right? Still touching base with, you know, the BD team, but it's not as pressing as a need, right? In other times of the year. So I would say that, but it comes down to, I think as a business owner, you have to delegate. That's what it comes down to at the end of the day. Like, unfortunately, you only have 8 hours a day. You can only do so much as one individual. So if you're going to delegate, you have to delegate to be successful. But I think the key with delegation is, do you empower people to be business owners themselves? Not renters, but I think owners. I got that from Uber, right? Like, be a business owner. Because if you own your house, you'll take care of it a lot more. But if people now rent or just stay overnight, like at a hotel, the level of care and commitment and dedication is not as high as someone who owns. So how do you empower your team to be owners of the business as well, right? Because if everyone now feels that they are a viable part of the product, the culture, the fabric of what you're now doing, they'll put forth the effort that is needed to be successful, and you don't, well, you can scale yourself. I like to tell people, I need to only make 8 decisions a year if I'm really good at my job. Right. I shouldn't be making a lot of decisions. I should make 8 decisions a year, big strategic decisions. But me saying, hey, Damon, what color is this button? Or what color the button should be? I should empower you enough to make that decision on your own instead of me having to be super, super hands-on with everything.
One thing I want to add is, because I had this conversation at dinner last night with a guy who's going to be a fractional CRO for a startup that just raised about $10 million. And he said that one thing they struggled with working with this guy didn't know his strengths, Lyle. You know, this guy was a technical guy and doesn't know anything about sales. So what I hear you saying is, you know, you got to focus on your strengths. You got to surround yourself with great people, and you got to delegate out those responsibilities, right? Have the self-awareness to know, hey, I'm strong in this, but I think you could just go much further if you're able to delegate out and put somebody in charge and give them the autonomy to like bring in somebody who has done it before in sales and knows what to do. That's how you help grow, right?
Absolutely. Like I said, like, you're going to have to delegate. And I think being self-aware of what you're good at, I think, is really, really necessary. Because, you know, my first boss at Uber was wonderful. She said, hey, you always want to hire someone smarter than you. It's counterintuitive, but you want to hire someone smarter than you. Because if they're smarter than you, like, they can do your job and they'll make you look good ultimately, which is, like, that's the only way you're going to multiply and take things off, right? Or is to basically surround yourself with talented people, because, you know, talent breeds success. Like, you know, success is contagious. Energy is contagious. If I now see Damon crushing it, I wouldn't want to crush it, right? So, like, that's what I think is somewhat lost. These days, obviously, that's a lot harder now than it was in the past. While technology is great that you and I can have a virtual connection today, there are certain things that can be done in person that can't be replicated virtually, and everything you can. Like my father says, you don't know what gets done at a coffee machine until you don't have a coffee machine, right? Whether that could be a copier, that could be the break room, it's all the same, right? But like, there are certain aspects and elements that I think remote work has been wonderful at. Like, you know, get talent, you can get better people, like, you can really broaden your reach. But at the same time, there is something about being together and cohesive, right? So I think as a leader, you're always struggling to fight these pros and cons, But at the end of the day, like, you want to put your people in success. You want to give them the resources and tools to be successful, whereas your job is not to free up blockers, whereas not to micromanage.
You're preaching to the choir. I mean, Learnit is I got about 70 employees. We're a remote first company, but right downstairs in my little office, I have 10 of my team members who flew in. And last night after dinner, we all said, there is no substitute for being in person, especially when it comes to collaboration. And I just think it's so important. There are pros and cons to everything, but you got to find the time for your team, you know, for your team to get together. Because at the end of the day, I you know, people could argue with me on this, but there's no replacement for getting people together in in-person collaboration. So Lyle, you know, we're kind of wrapping up now, and I want to be respectful of your time, but look, where do you see Spry? What's the future hold for Spry?
I think 2024 will be a record year for us. Like I said, exponential growth in terms of revenue, customers, engagement. So hopefully we're building on that momentum in 2025. Right, without like getting the details, if we can see the same success we saw this year, next year, I'll be thrilled. But more efficiently, I'm looking at more non-traditional KPIs as a business leader. Not everyone looks at top line, but I'm thinking about, where do I provide value? Can I now lower the time to value for my customers? Okay, how quickly can I get them to that aha moment? So if that aha moment now takes X hours, can I be 0.5 hours in the future next year, right? How do I now have people now say, hey, Lyle, like, I spoke to so-and-so and they are gushing about your product. Those are the KPIs I'm now focused at for this year, right? I think we just launched the customer page on the website recently, which was really rewarding to see some of the feedback we got from customers as I was talking to them. It was awesome to hear how they truly felt about the product or what they liked and didn't like. And overwhelmingly right now, it's a lot more pros than positives than negatives. As a leader, I definitely think was obviously things that we can improve, but hearing now someone who went from having pencil and paper or a whiteboard to using Spry and says, hey man, you freed up hours of my life. Or it's a lot easier to now do this process is really like gratifying to hear. And I think for me next year, can I double that? Can I hear more of those stories? Can we impact and empower a lot more people across the collegiate athletic space is kind of what's next in my eyes. A little product standpoint, we have some really cool features to follow. Feel free to find us on LinkedIn or like, you know, reach out to our newsletter. Awesome things coming up, but can we continue to delight our customers is, I would say, my North Star for 2025.
Well, and this kind of comes full circle. We started off with talking about curiosity, and what we're talking about now is exactly that, you know, is getting curious to see what you can do to get better. I do have one more question for you, and then I want you to tell the listeners where to connect with you. What's it like being a dad? You've got a kid 2 months old.
It's awesome. I have a little guy at home. My wife's a rock star. Words kind of hard to describe it, to pick one word to describe the experience. I'd say it's exciting, it's humbling, it's a lot of sacrifice. But overall, like I said, it's been really, really great. My wife is a rock star, and I'm lucky my kid sleeps. So I've heard from a few people so far. So very grateful on that, but I've enjoyed every moment of it so far. Like I said, me and the little guy get to spend mornings together. It's our time. We have some tummy time. We go for walks. And I've really enjoyed it. I think I'll enjoy it more when he can actually see me. But so far, it's been wonderful. No complaints.
There's nothing better. We talked about that before we jumped on. Where can our listeners connect with you at?
Feel free to find me on LinkedIn. Lyle Adams. I think it's backscore Lyle Adams is one. You can always go to Spry's website, www.spry.so. If you email us there, I will respond. I'm always happy to connect with people. Like I said, curiosity is one of my greatest strengths. So anyone who reaches out, I'll get back to you. I promise. It might not be instantaneously, but I'll make an effort to respond to all emails and all requests and messages. Because I was once out there seeking feedback or ideas from those in the industry, and I wouldn't be here without their time and dedication. So I'm a big believer in paying it forward.
That's awesome, Lyle. You've been awesome. So much great wisdom. And I'm excited to see Spry's journey, your journey, both as a business leader and, of course, as a dad. And what I ask our listeners out there, what I want you to do is think about somebody who could benefit from my conversation today with Lyle. And I want you to shoot them, text them this conversation, because I know that they'll get value out of it. Until next time, everybody, here we go, Lyle. Stay curious and keep learning. Have a great day, everybody. See ya.
Thank you so much.